Hey folks, welcome to the show. Today, after many months where, you know, me, Sharad, as well as our guest would sit in the same room, or at least me and Sharad would be sitting in the same room, we have decided to take the remote approach. So we have with us Sharad Tupran as well as our guest, Badal Malik from KarmaLife.ai with us. Hey Sharad, how's it going? First, I'll go over to you. How are you, man?
All good. It's good. And a little bit of a different setup today, but I'm excited. And we've also reverted. We are seeing another sort of, let's call it finance or a fintech or lending place. So we are back into our sweet spot.
Absolutely. So, you know, we have with us Badal. Badal is the co-founder and CBO. Badal, I assume CBO is Chief Business Officer. tell me if I'm wrong. From Karma Life. Essentially, I like the way Karma Life described themselves. It's financial solutions for India's growing gig economy. So I think that's pretty self-explanatory. But over to Badal. Hey Badal, how's it going? How are you?
Hi Nikhil. Hi Sharad. Nice to be here. Doing well. How are you guys?
All good. No, the pleasure is all ours. Thanks so much for joining. Badal, obviously, you know, you have a very you know, we have kind of known each other. I've spoken with you earlier as well when you were a part of Catalyst, which is obviously a donor-funded platform, which was serving last-mile inclusive digital finance. You have a pretty solid background in financial inclusion. That's a space that I think you've looked at for the past many years, and now you're part of Karma Life, which basically provides, as per our understanding, lending solutions to gig economy workers. So pretty much right in your sweet spot.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, like when you look back at your career, sometimes, you know, what seemed like a random walk starts to make sense. So yeah, I mean, you know, I've been doing Karma Life for the last, I think, 2 years now, and it's been an interesting 2 years, as you guys can imagine. But we just raised a small round, and you know, things are looking exciting.
Great. No, I think, you know, what would be good, Badal, to start is to, you know, get a very kind of vanilla understanding. I mean, no business is vanilla, but we'll try our level best to kind of understand, you know, what exactly is the model behind Karma Life. Like you know, we do kind of get a basic sense that, you know, you are kind of providing, I would say, lending products, lines of credit to, you know, folks who are working for either as, you know, delivery partners with Zomato or, you know, delivery partners with Flipkart or any other or a cab driver, you know, working with Uber. You're kind of providing lending solutions to them. But how does it exactly, you know, work? What's your basic offering or play here?
So, Nikhil, let me take a step back. I'll just start with the pain point, right? So, you know, the financial life of a gig worker is characterized by cash flow volatility, both on the, you know, earnings as well as the expenditure side. There is significant exposure to shocks, health shocks, financial shocks, market shocks. And third, I mean, you know, they constitute a low skill base, and so there are limited access to career progression or career opportunities, right? It's also very, you know, it varies by, you know, how private markets are doing and venture capital is doing and all of that. And so, so basically, you know, I mean, if you just look at the short-term liquidity issues alone, mm-hmm. I mean, our data has shown that, you know, almost, you know, somewhere between 75 to 90% of gig workers face regular earning shortfalls, right? And and so finance is a key enabler to drive income stability and resilience.
So, right? Like when you say, you know, just like when you say gig worker, what do you exactly mean? Are these like mainly folks who don't have a formalized employment but work as like an independent contractor for any of these large aggregators or platforms? Is that how you are characterizing a gig worker?
Yeah, so we look at gig and contract workers broadly, but I mean, if you want to get really specific, then yes, the digital platform worker is, you know, the gig worker that is in scope. But you know, as you probably know, the broader gig and contract worker ecosystem has a few different, you know, engagement models, and it's very crisscross. So we look at, I mean, you can, our customer base right now, our target segment is broadly gig and contract workers. You have people who do, you know, task-based, paper task kind of models. You have people who are on more assured kind of contracts, right? They might be a monthly or fortnightly or whatever income, right? That they're guaranteed, provided they show up to work.
Right.
That's interesting, Badal. I mean, straight off the bat, right? I mean, from a very simplistic standpoint, why this sort of target demographic? And the reason I ask is, I mean, there seems to be a general notion, right? I mean, when you're sort of underwriting or lending, you'd ideally, an ideal credit-worthy guy who has predictable stream of cash flow, who's got a high level of predictability in outlook of their cash flows. So, I mean, one argument is this is an underserved market, so hence it's up there to grab. But is there any other salient features here which makes your value proposition sort of tie in nicely?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So another piece is, so finance is important for them, and they do not get finance, even kind of, you know, credit cards for that matter, because, they are characterized by real-time risk, right? So, I mean, there is no permanent contract per se, right? Job contract, that is. And therefore, you know, I mean, therefore it is, you know, there is a fair amount of risk which nobody is willing to underwrite. Mm-hmm. And therefore, our value proposition is to use alternative data, primarily starting with work data that we get from the employer or aggregator platform, and then build, you know, based on those, you know, that work data history, underwrite and build, a path for them to start along, that we enable them to access liquidity and then progress along that liquidity path. Mm-hmm. So broadly, I mean, our mission, our mission is to provide sustainable finance, which we see as a combination of liquidity, savings, and insurance, right? Right now, of course, liquidity is kind of the need of the hour. It's always the pull product, right? And so we start, we have earned wage access, which is, you know, for their daily expenses. We provide a line of credit, which you know, addresses unplanned, small expenses. And then we right now are going up to 3 to 6 month term loans for larger lumpy expenditures that they may have. And that, you know, we move along that kind of path, right? We also have spent a lot of time around building a trust-based UX UI, that's a user experience. And that is, again, you know, addressing the issue of the large trust deficit vis-a-vis formal financial products that we see amongst the segment, right? So in that way, we are reinventing the entire user experience journey to create relevance, engagement, you know, reinforce trust. And there are many hallmarks to this. We enable a simple digital onboarding, which is 3 minutes. And so basically the worker is able to access liquidity instantly, right? Because, I mean, for them, need is immediate, and that convenience is of essence. We enable new to credit users that otherwise would not get credit. And therefore, we are able to start with a much wider coverage base, right? If we work with, say, an employer ecosystem, right? We can cover a very large base. We also, you know, do have things like subscription based pricing, you know, flat pricing, which is very easy for folks to understand. They know exactly what they're paying. It's transparent. It's one fee, no hidden fees, etc. Right? So it creates trust and affinity. And then we also enable easy repayments that are linked to the employer or the aggregator payout. Right? So that way. It's again easy for gig workers, because, you know, one thing they are short of is time. And then we work through employers, right? So we have a B2B2C model,
right?
We frame the product as a platform intermediated benefit, and that allows us to keep our costs and risks low, and we collaborate with these employer/aggregator partners to channel these benefits, which in turn, by the way, have, you know, business benefits for them, right? Because happy workers, and just removing this day-to-day stress that their workforce feels, enables, you know, benefits like more productivity, engagement, retention, right? We're seeing that actually play out in the data. And lastly, I mean, I'd say that, you know, just on the business model point, you know, the, we partner with balance sheet holders, right? So we have NBFC partners, P2P platforms, as well as in future, you know, more financial services manufacturers, license holders, well, and their insurance companies or asset managers, et cetera, on the back end. So our stack is built in a way that allows us to do what we do well, which is manage risk and build the right user experience, but then connect, you know, finances as in balance sheets and financial licenses to financial products to the end user.
Right. Very fascinating. Obviously, there are a lot of pieces here. So I had a few questions, you know. Firstly, like when you guys like, you know, enable underwriting or underwrite, I mean, is it purely kind of cash flow based unsecured type lending, or do you like secure it on potential receivables, or you know, like you mentioned that you have arrangements with the employers themselves, and essentially you know, you kind of service through the payments that are coming directly. How does it what are the mechanics of
that? So I mean, it is unsecured lending at the end of the day, but but there is, I mean, we do cap risk by you know, having a lien on the worker payout,
right.
And then depending on the level and duration or tenure of the product, you know, there is more risk exposure or less exposure, right? So if you do something like earned wage access, you're basically, you know, kind of you know, we're giving liquidity against accrued earnings, right? So there's still some risk, but it's significantly lower risk. Right? Whereas if you start doing line of credit, it is on the basis of forecasted earnings where you get into a little more risk, right? And then if you go to longer term, say 3 to 6 month loans, then, you know, you again get more risk, right? So and the risk here is, I mean, because we have, you know, we have our partnerships enable us to link the repayment to payouts. The risk is really around them. It's around structural churn on some of these platforms. And that's ultimately what we are, you know, mitigating or monitoring and managing from a risk perspective.
And you don't like put your own balance sheet? Like you mainly work with third-party lenders,
not,
right?
We're not an NBFC. We don't, you know, at this point in time, we don't intend to become one.
Right, understood. And could you like explain like how the revenue model really works here, in the sense that you mentioned that there is a subscription based offering, right, to the to the borrower, but I you know, you obviously are also serving a kind of a lead generation you know, use case for the ultimate lender. So how does the exact, you know, revenue flow work here for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, we have input costs, right? Which is based on our agreement. We get, I mean, we're not really, I guess we are technically a lead generator, but we are, you know, we underwrite and we, you know, get the reward along with the risk, right?
So
we have input costs and then we have output costs, and that kind of manages, you know, we have to manage our margin in that, right? In terms of revenue streams, we do have, you know, subscription-based model, so it is a recurring revenue, a steady recurring revenue. Our repeat rates are pretty high,
right?
You know, and there are in the future. I mean, we see other revenue streams as well. You know, there are a whole set of solutions, and you know, both financial as well as non-financial services, right, that can be empowered through finance of this kind, and you know, that gives us an opportunity. But that's further out into the future.
And you earlier said sort of one price, and when I talk about price, I mean not the price of the subscription service, but general underwriting cost of financing. How do you sort of go about pricing it? Just because the variables here, like you yourself said, there's a lot more inherent volatility in your sort of potential target audience. How do you sort of go around pricing it? Is that sort of somewhat standardized across across borrowers, or do you actually basically how bespoke can you go from borrower to borrower based on their own profiles? Like that's sort of what I wanted to understand.
No. So, I mean, if it's platform intermediated, then, you know, at platform level, there are some expectations. And, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, we are, you know, I mean, I think it is an ecosystem play, right? I mean, between the backend NBFC partners, us, the you know, the channel partner, and that's the employer, the end user. So, I mean, I think it's everybody's interest to build, you know, sustainable, viable, financially, you know, unit economic positive models, right? So from that perspective, yeah, but there is some standardization. I mean, there are a couple of models. There's a model where, you know, the user pays. There's a model where the employer kind of, you know, sponsors it as a benefit, right?
Okay.
We can even enable hybrid models, right? But there is standardization in pricing at an employer level, but it's all based on the risk profile at that level, right? The risk profile of the segment.
Mm-hmm.
And that obviously goes into that.
A typical, you know, like you mentioned that the tenure is around 3 to 6 months in terms of the lending proposition. Like, what kind of, like, what's the size of these loans? And, you know, I mean, in terms of, are they like interest-free loans where some sort of upfront is charged or some sort of a processing fee goes out?
Pink sheet newspaper these days, like, they're just a lot of underwriting plays in the market right now. Basically, what I was trying to say is that there are a lot of fintech and lending plays that one can see in the market these days, right? And you're seeing the sector sort of still very early days, but how are you sort of seeing it evolve? Do you see it sort of demographic, identifying the right target and sort of lend it like that? And what models you are seeing sort of thrive? And I wanted to link that with the second big piece of underwriting is collections, right? And how do you sort of go about that, and what the thought process is in collections?
Sure. So I think, you know, I mean, we've learned as we've gone along, right? One big difference that I see amongst different competing models is, you know, the use of technology, right? I mean, a lot of the underwriting models are basically traditional underwriting that simply, you know, digitize the process and, you know, apply it to the segment. We're trying to do something a little different here, which is we have built our technology and product, you know, kind of designed to fit for the sector, right? Our firm belief is that you can only solve this problem with alternative data, like work data, you know, mobile data that is, you know, behavioral data that is generated on the mobile phone, transactional data, so on.
Yeah.
So we've built our capabilities, you know, alongside that kind of deep tech requirement. And, you know, we've actually in the last couple of years invested a fair amount of attention and energy in figuring out how to ingest, you know, work data, how to make sense of it, how to, you know, capture the intelligence layer on top and make, you know, strong, good predictions. So that I think is one difference, and, you know, where I'm just kind of clarifying what we think are our advantages. Yeah. But of course, time should tell. I think that there is certainly, you know, I mean, there is certainly both on the underwriting side as well as on the experiential side in terms of the UX, UI and some of the trust factors that I laid out. You know, I mean, different kind of cognition levels at for different segments. I mean, I think there is something to be said about segment-specific products, right? And we are building something that is, you know, relevant for the gig and contract sector. And by the way, I mean, 85% of India's workforce is non-salaried, right? So
yeah,
let's not forget that. I mean, this is the dominant sector in that sense, and it's growing.
Yeah.
So I do think, I mean, in terms of gazing into the crystal ball and you know, trying to predict the future, I mean, I do think there will be some consolidation. I think right now they're competing models and people are trying to see what is viable from a value and risk trade-off standpoint. Like I said, some have gone, some still exist. And I think there will be a consolidation play. There will probably be a couple of major players that emerge in the next, I'd say, couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, hopefully the ecosystem will come around, you know, it'll become, you know, more streamlined, and you'll see more appetite, right? Also from a lender standpoint to expose themselves to the segment.
Yeah.
And I think that will also bring costs down, and you know, that whole virtuous loop will hopefully catalyze, and you know, things will grow.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And sort of collections, how do you sort of build your strategy around that aspect?
Yeah, no, that's a good one. And I can't say that we have cracked it per se, but we are learning. And, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, you know, it also is, you know, when you're talking about small ticket sizes, right, you have to also, I mean, it's a very different collections model. It's a low touch collections model. Right? Otherwise, there's no way you can have the same collection models that works for a 50,000 rupee loan for a 5 to 10,000 rupee loan, right? It just won't work. So we are learning that. A lot of that is, again, data-based, right? A lot of it is automated, data-based. And then, you know, there is, you know, there are certain triggers which, and certain you know, scenarios where an agency can help, right? So we're still trying to figure out that balance. I don't think we're quite there. And we're also, again, even there, I mean, you know, there is room for the ecosystem to come alive. So, for example, I mean, there is, you know, there's been talk around expanding the whole eNash, you know, capability to kind of, you know, to create a lien around inflows into a, you know, designated bank account. So you have the timing of when somebody's getting paid, right? Now,
yeah,
if and when that happens, it'll make collections easier, right, for everybody. And I think that is an ecosystem challenge that we have to address together. But yeah, between what we are doing and what we hope the ecosystem will do, I'm sure we'll solve that problem.
Right. Badal, like, you know, just to kind of understand the product a bit more, and I think, you know, I lost the audio in between. So, I mean, forgive me if I'm repeating. You know, sure, typically you had mentioned that, you know, your typical loans are like 3 to 6 month in tenure. I mean, what kind of ticket sizes are we looking at? Like 5,000, 10,000? Those are the numbers that you typically look at for a loan?
Yeah, so you know, actually, at the lowest end of the spectrum, you'd be surprised to know we do 500 rupee loans per week. We've done that, and we've seen like amazing traction for that. And on the top end of the spectrum, you can say 20,000-25,000 for a, you know, 3 to 6 month kind of tenure, right?
Right.
So that's kind of the broad spectrum. And you know, like I said, I mean, we our platform supports all sorts of configurations. So we can, you know, we have supported weekly models, right, where you have, you know, weekly loans that you know, kind of like earned wage access or a line of credit type facility, fortnightly, monthly, three monthly.
Right. So I mean, they sound like, you know, kind of a low ticket, high frequency. You know, type of products, right?
That is. I mean, that is in our mind. That was actually a, you know, an acute need and a hugely unmet need, right? Because everybody starts with term loans,
right?
And there is some bias there because of the economics. So again, it comes down to building based on technology that enables a real, you know, low cost to serve. That enables these, you know, this. I mean, this type of liquidity, this type of recurring small ticket liquidity.
Right.
And that's kind of what we've done. And that's where we, you know, occupy some positioning. Now, the other good part about this from our perspective is that it is, you know, because it naturally caps risk, right? Because you're limiting exposure. And at the same time, you're able to, you know, kind of cover a much wider base, right? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you take something like earned wage access, everybody, and if you have no minimum ticket size for the limit, then everybody has some earning coming through, right? You can, I mean, practically you can cover 100% of a worker pool,
right?
And then you can build on top of that because you get that kind of trove of repayment data to work with. So that's kind of like, you know, it is very much a progressive credit model because I think that is the best way to optimize.
So you pretty much like act like a credit builder, right, for them.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
And when you're doing that, I mean, I assume that you use technology to make sure that disbursements are flexible so that, you know, their actual liquidity requirements can be met. I mean, are these propositions like mostly you know, do they operate on like a interest, zero interest rate, but like some sort of a processing fee or upfront kind of a model, or there's an interest element also which comes into the picture?
Yeah, so as risk, I mean, as the horizon, you know, the tenure increases and mm-hmm. risk becomes higher, then that kind of processing fee structure becomes more relevant.
Yeah.
I mean, we are experimenting with various types of pricing models.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, across you know, processing fee, you know, the kind of flat you know, interest rate, you know, equivalent fee, and then. Mm. Even late fees, right?
Right. Yeah.
Because the idea is to build kind of, you know, drive value-based pricing that is efficient, where you know, you have, you know, you're not cross-subsidizing across too much, you know, that's a challenge in itself.
Mm-hmm.
But we do. We are experimenting with various structures.
Right. But and how do you manage the flows on the supply end, like from the third party lenders, because obviously they won't be that familiar with such kind of, you know, flexible, like high frequency loan structures, right?
No. So we I mean, you know, it's been a little bit of a, you know, it's been a lot of this has been bringing the ecosystem alongside, right?
Yeah.
Our loan portfolio has grown. Mm-hmm. You know, we're growing. I mean, we have a very healthy kind of growth rate at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
It is you know, I mean, the you know, just the performance of the loan book has been it's been illuminating to a lot of our partners, right?
Yeah.
So we've you know, as alongside that, as we've demonstrated this, we've increased the number of partners also on the back end.
Right,
so we have some
right,
diversification.
Right,
different
right,
partners
right,
have different understood. Requirements, different you know, cost structures, etc. So all of that feeds into it.
Understood. And you know, obviously you mentioned alternate data, and you know, essentially you know, you have built a technology layer, right? From an alternate data standpoint, I mean, there are lots of models which are out there, right? You know, we hear of you know, lenders doing everything from penny drops to, you know, checking through phone books to see, you know, to, you know, kind of taking both Aadhaar as well as PAN to make sure there is, you know, less scope for fraud. Like, what kind of, you know, data points or frameworks do you use
sure.
in your engine?
Yeah. So obviously, I mean, you know, our belief is that traditional data markers don't make sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have focused on alternate data. We, like I said, we start with the work data. Work data can be, you know, a whole range of things from, you know, work or transactions like activity, orders, earnings, performance, ratings, right? Then we have transaction data, right, in terms of how people are using credit, how they repay, all of that. Then we have mobile behavioral data, because, you know, our app, you know, is the engagement is pretty high, and so we get a pretty good read for our active users. You know, so that, you know, that is kind of that is the data that we harness, and we've built, you know, algorithms on top of that to manage the risk. Now, you know, I'm not part of the technology team, but
mm-hmm.
I can talk about maybe two or three ways in which we have, you know, use the data, right? So one is we have what is a proprietary risk score or a Karma score,
mm-hmm.
Which is driven by this user permissioned alternative data. And this, you know, this helps us during the initial user onboarding process, as well as helps us estimate, you know, user risk on a continuing basis for future credit cycles as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
By considering things like how much usage has been done, repayments, other financial behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's one.
Right.
And that, again, you know, in terms of application, it allows for both, you know, kind of NTC customers to be financially included, and then also for them to progress along a path, right, a credit builder path. Then we also have dynamic credit allotment, right? So we assign credit limits that are based on user performance or based on past repayments.
Right.
Right. And so our credit limits can change dynamically, right?
Right.
And that is unique. I mean, I think that's different. I mean, I don't think that is the norm.
Hmm.
And that allows us to build in, you know, natural incentive structures as well, that where we can reward users that have shown good so-called financial karma, with higher, more flexible credit terms of credit, right? And it also allows us to manage the downside risk. And then lastly, you know, even around fund projections, right? Because I mean, there's this whole segment and its usage is not really understood, right? So we use time series based forecasting models to predict future funds requirements, and then that allows us to, you know, figure out what is the right float that we need to carry, you know, to offer instant credit that ensures, you know, even our operations are cost effective. So those are like, you know, two or three ways in which we are using the data to build a better model, better operational and ultimate business model.
Right.
Interesting. And what do you think, Badal, how are your potential target audience or customers, how are they discovering your platform? Is it like, basically, I'm trying to get a sense of your advertising strategy. Is it just a lot of advertising, or are there other tie-ups, like more physical approaches?
We have a B2B2C model. So we work with channel partners, and so we exclusively right now distribute through those channels, right? We are live with most of the major gig platforms already. We're starting to kind of gain inroads into, you know, more traditional manpower intensive companies. But the idea is to, you know, intermediate through these channels, because see, the workers anyway have trust, right? There's an existing equation of trust with the channel partner, right? Mm-hmm. And so they basically, you know, we have integration models, we have different integration models, and you know, it can be seamlessly either, you know, discovered through the partner app or through a simple flow, communication flow that comes initially or is initiated by the partner. But either way, it's through that closed ecosystem.
Understood.
You know, I'm very curious to understand, Badal, like, what was the pitch of Karma Life to employers? Like, I understand, obviously, to the gig workers or to the banks and NBFCs, but like, what exactly was the, you know, angle there? Like, is it like, and number two, and that the second question is probably a subset of the first one only. Like, when it comes to the gig worker themselves, is Karma Life's visibility as Karma Life, or is it like a white labeled offering that comes through the to the employer, to them?
Yeah. So I mean, typically it's powered by Karma Life, but we co-brand our solutions, right? And the certainly the you know, the benefit and the glory of you know, the solution itself is shared very much with the employer, right? That's the promise to the employer. In terms of the overall pitch, it is one is, you know, There are enlightened employers, thankfully, already who understand the importance of doing right by their you know, workers, particularly if those workers are, you know, either their you know, key ambassadors to their customers or what have you, right? I think there is certainly, you know, there's empirical evidence from abroad and more so in India, where people are waking up to the fact that you know, workers, when they have financial stress, that can be a huge impediment, right? So if you remove that day-to-day financial stress, you really kind of are creating, you know, you're creating more engaged workers, more productive workers, and more, you know, workers that are more likely to be retained, right? So there's a huge cost benefit, right, there for HR departments. Now, and just to give you a data point, we're already seeing, and we've done, you know, this is consistent across different deployments. We see, you know, boost in engagement or even in churn reduction upwards of 20%. I mean, you know, it could be 20 to 50%, right? So this is pretty significant. I mean, this is still kind of, you know, I mean, it is, we're still early on, but we've been very heartened by the data, and you know, we're uncovering more insights there. But that is really the pitch, right? I mean, you know, it also reduces their own operational overhead, because you know, they notoriously get you know, they get demand for salary advance, right? Managing those operations can be a real nuisance, right? And it's obviously not their core business. So this just streamlines that. It is, you know, at no risk or liability to them. We take on the risk, right? I mean, overall, it's sort of a win-win proposition.
Right. Right. Super fascinating. You know, just to kind of, sum it up, I would also like to understand what's your view on, you know, the narrative around regularization of gig workers, you know, in the workforce. For example, like in the US, in UK, there is generally a fairly strong wave in that direction where, you know, regulators are understanding that even though gig workers are kind of classified as independent contractors, but they are often tied to a certain employer, and a fair amount of operational liability that should have been with the employer kind of ends up falling on the shoulders of the gig workers themselves. There are pros and cons to that entire narrative, and you know, depends on where one is sitting. But I mean, what's your take on that? Do you see a similar kind of formalization imminent in the Indian context, or you feel that the Indian ecosystem is very different to start with, in the sense that I keep on kind of thinking, you know, when I moved back from the UK to India, like in UK, going in an Uber was actually sitting in a stranger's car, but in India it's still a cab, right? I mean there are very different fundamental differences between how the gig economy works in different parts of the world.
So a couple of things here. One is that, you know, gig in India is still, I mean, digital gig is nascent, right? And it's still growing. But if you look at, I mean, there was a study, I think last year, by BCG and Michael and Susan Dell Foundation, they predicted 90 million jobs, right? Gig jobs, that add up to 1.25% to India's GDP. Right, and that is staggering, right? That is, I think, a prediction for the next 10 years or so. Mm-hmm. So another way to think about it is that, you know, today we have around 300 to 400 million non-farm blue collars, and at least 100 million of those are organized sector, linked to the organized sector, right? So in other words, they are either gig or organized contract, right? And not including the informal under the table folks, right? So it is massive. I think the recognition is there. In fact, you know, you guys might be familiar with the new Social Security Code, which recognizes the gig worker for the first time, and a whole set of benefits around health insurance, pension, so on and so forth, that that social protection that is given to them. I think that platform initiated or intermediated financial benefits are mm-hmm. actually a great complement to that, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And because, I mean, you know, that kind of, again, the small ticket recurring liquidity that we talked about, right? I mean, it does not exist, is not part of a traditional kind of social protection umbrella,
yeah.
But it is a core need for the sector, right? And it basically helps folks from actually getting into debt traps, right? That then become kind of, they can just, you know, kind of spiral out of control, right? I mean, COVID actually showed us that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of worker incomes, their livelihoods were destroyed, and people had to kind of, they consume their savings and they don't really have any safety nets, and just created more strife.
Right.
And it took a long time for them to kind of claw back.
Right.
So I mean, I think, you know, that is actually a classic. I mean, that's a classic example. But I think that there is recognition from policymakers, regulators, and the private sector ecosystem,
right?
Employer aggregators as well as solution providers like us, to start working together and building the right solutions that help these folks.
Right, right. This was super fascinating. And, it obviously gives a very different lens to kind of better understand the nuances and complexities within this part of the economic segment. Thank you so much for your time. We'll, we wish you and the Karma Life team all the best. We'll surely be keeping, track of the company, in terms of newer and bigger milestones. This was a lot of fun. What do you say, Sharad?
Oh, thank you, Sharad. Thank you, Nikhil. It was great chatting with you, and thanks again for the opportunity.
No, absolutely. No, thank you so much. And so, yeah, with this... I think we'll wrap up this episode. We have with us Nikhil Arora and Sharad Tuprons signing off. Thank you. Yeah.